Okay, we're going to continue with the Hind Let Loose. We're up to period 5. This is the 5th period of the history of the Church of Scotland. And the testimony that is covered in this section shields. This is period 5, containing testimony for the last Reformation from prelacy in all its steps from the year 1638 to 1660. So first of all, we need to keep in mind that the period of time that we're going to be talking about right now is a 22-year window. And it is a period of time that comprehends what we call the Second Reformation. The First Reformation is from popery. The second is from prelacy. And there are other things as well. We'll talk about them. 1638 is an important point. Because it was in 1638 that several things happened. 1638, we have the renewal of the National Covenant. 1638, we have, as we'll see, the first free General Assembly in the Church for quite some time. Now, why do we call it a free General Assembly? Well, it's free. It's considered a free General Assembly because it's not an assembly that has been called or culled by the king. So he didn't call it. And he didn't go through and say that those people can't be there, okay? The membership of that General Assembly was left up to the presbyteries, no longer were real Presbyterians kept from coming, and no longer were they able to pack the court with these prelates that had earlier showed up in these courts. So that's the one end. 1638. On the other end, 1660. Does anyone know what that date might be?
The start of the Killing Times?
Well, it is, but it is for a reason.
Some kind of overthrow of the established Reformation?
Yes, it is that, but in 1660 is known as the...
Is that the Glorious Revolution?
No.
The ejection?
No. There was an ejection in 1661 to so on, but no, it's a result of what happens in 1660, the ejection. 1660 is a year that Charles II... comes to the throne after the Cromwellian period, and it's known as the Restoration. So it's a restoration of the House of Stuart. All right, so that's the period of time that we have in view, between 1638 and 1660. Now, there's a lot that happens. We're not going to be able to touch on all of it. Again, my purpose in talking about the various points that I bring up is to give you a bit of an overview of A Hind Let Loose and to encourage you to read it. So, question 104, what is peculiar about this period and its advance of the testimony? What is peculiar is this. The church, during this period, is advancing to its greatest height of purity and power that either the Church of Scotland or any other church ever has arrived at. Right. It's the greatest degree of power that they ever arrived unto. Okay. Moreover, the testimony again goes from being passive to active. Now, this period of time, if you're familiar with the Act, Declaration, Testimony, you will recognize that it was for the covenanted Reformation between 1638 and 1649. Those principles are the ones. And that really, as we're going to see, 1649 is the beginning of the end for this period of time. Okay, things start to happen within the church and within the nation, and a lot of what they do is undone. The undoing of which will lay the groundwork for period 6, which will encompass the testimony from 1660 to the writing of Hind Let Loose in 1687. The matter of this period's testimony was the same as it was before, for Christ's kingly prerogative. So one thing that we want to point out, and Shields is very clear on this, each period, as he's defined them, has question 106, what did the successive periods of testimony oppose? Each of these successive periods, the last period always included everything that went before. Now, that's an important principle, okay, that you have to include all that has gone before in terms of reform, or active testimony, I should say.
You have to build upon it, correct?
The testimony of the church is never shrinking. It's always increasing because of error and persecution and heresy and so on. So that's really what they're talking about here. Or what he's talking about. So the first period, if you remember, had what he calls Gentilism, which is really paganism. So in the earliest, that period one was a testimony against paganism. The second period was against popery. The third was against popery and tyranny. The fourth was against prelacy and supremacy. What do they mean by supremacy?
Hierarchical bishops?
No.
Erastianism.
And the fifth period, which is the one we're talking about now, is against, then, we have to take in all of them together, paganism, popery, prelacy, tyranny, Erastianism, and to that he wants to add sectarianism. What is sectarianism?
Denominationalism.
Denominationalism. Isn't it funny that and we're going to see this really... The very last period that he talks about. I mean, we're now at the height of Reformation and the testimony, at the height of Reformation is against denominationalism, and that's the last time we had any reform. We've been contending with denominationalism, sectarianism, ever since.
Which is because toleration?
Yeah, well, that there are other things that we're going to testify against as well in the next period in here. And there are other things that are then added, you know, as history progresses. But this is certainly, you know, it's building one thing on top of another. So you have sectarianism, and as we'll see, there's also a party called Malignants. Hmm. Malignants are people who either wouldn't take the covenant or took the covenant, you know, with their fingers crossed, essentially. They're going to interpret it the way they want. So, what happens, if you remember, in Scotland, in that previous period, as prelacy was growing, it finally got to a point where it they were ready to impose a liturgy on the church, the bishops. And the dean, one of the deans, went into St. Giles and began to read the prayer book. And a woman named Jenny Geddes picked up her stool, threw it at the guy, and said, "Are you going to say Mass in my ear?" And it started a riot. It stopped the imposition of the liturgy, and in the gap, you have this Free General Assembly, where it created a little bit of space, and they have a General Assembly. So, you know, before men get too puffed up, you got to remember that the Second Reformation, to some extent, was started by a woman chucking her stool at some Episcopalian who wouldn't shut up. All right, in 1638, then, they had their first Free General Assembly, which, again, is an assembly that the first one in years, when they actually call an assembly. They're not meeting because the king told them they had to. The church itself is calling the assembly and appointing everyone who's going to be there. So that's why it's called a Free General Assembly. And once they had that Free General Assembly, they began to condemn a series of things. Question 107. All right, first, they condemned the six preceding assemblies which had established prelacy. And they weren't, those six preceding assemblies were not necessarily every year. This was extending back a bit. One of the things that occurred during the previous period was you had a number of people who were pushing basically to, these are bishops generally, pushing to restrict the meeting of the General Assembly, and so it was only very irregular. But each time they met, the previous six assemblies, they did something else that was designed to lay into the Constitution of the Church of Scotland prelacy. In 1638, when you have a free General Assembly, they immediately declare all those six preceding assemblies null and void. Now, why are they doing that? Well, they're not even going to go through and try to pick out what might have been good, if any. They're not going to ratify the acts of those preceding assemblies. Okay, they're going to write them out of the book. They're not going to be viewed as having anything to contribute to canon law in the church. Well, their decisions are not going to be appealed to in any kind of controversy. They're viewed as worthless, really. Okay, the second thing that they do is they get rid of the service book, which is the prayer book, the one that had started the problem with Jenny Geddes, the one they were trying to bring in. They just say, no, that's a non-starter. We're not going to do that. If you know what's good for keeping the peace of the church, you won't even try to bring this kind of nonsense into the Church of Scotland. It's gone. All right, third, beside condemning the service book, they also condemned the High Commission. What was the High Commission? Anybody who's heard me reading from Calderwood, in his True History of the Church of Scotland, the High Commission was really what was also called, and actually I just recently heard someone use this term, Star Court, like a secret court where decisions were made that were going to bind the church. And they would come up with things, an agenda for the church, and then they would send their bishops and others in to pack the court and do that bidding. Well, they got rid of that High Commission. They didn't want a bunch of noblemen and rich people sitting around determining what was going to happen within the church simply based upon, you know, what they found convenient or amenable to their desires. Yeah,
kind of like the Bilderberg groups and all these secret meetings. Is it just with relation to the church?
With relation to the church. It wasn't quite what, you know, that's taking some of this to a bigger extent, I suppose. All right. The fourth thing they did is they deposed all the bishops. Now, if you remember any of the controversy leading into the bishops, you know, there was all kinds of promised restraint for the bishops. Status of the bishops was really not going to be very high. They made all of these promises about how limited in scope these bishoprics were going to be, and then they started packing the courts, and all of a sudden you had just a handful of men in Scotland who were wielding supreme power in the church. Presbyterianism is republicanism in church government. Presbyterians don't like an aristocracy in the church. It's not acceptable. So they deposed all the bishops. Fifth, they abjured prelatic government in the church. The idea of church government with a hierarchy of bishops. They They denounce it. Just say no. Sixth, they reject the five articles of Perth, which were, anybody remember?
Kneeling, private communion.
Kneeling at communion, private communion.
Private baptism.
Private baptism.
Confirmation.
Confirmation.
Holy days.
Holy days, right. Okay, they reject it. And then the last thing that they condemn or reject is churchmen being put in places of civil power and trust. Mm. Right, this idea of confusion. You know, there are a lot of times people hear what Presbyterians are saying, Jure Divina Presbyterians, they'll read the Westminster Confession or something, and they think that we're confused about church and state. Okay? Presbyterianism, properly understood, has always rejected the notion that a minister in the church should be allowed to be a minister in the state, or vice versa. Right? There was some controversy even having people with places of civil power and trust as ruling elders. Okay, lest there be too much confusion in jurisdiction. So they were very careful in drawing lines or boundaries between church and state. That is not to be confused with, you know, Jefferson's Baptistic wall of separation between church and state. Like, they're not rejecting the idea that church and state have some overlapping interests and have a compelling interest to help one another. But those jurisdictions should not be confused, and in order to avoid that, they really want to avoid having ministers in places of power and trust. Now, the reason that in particular gets mentioned is, if you are familiar at all with the British system of government, they have an upper house and a lower house. The upper house is called the House of Lords. And in the upper house, in addition to the nobility, the bishops also had a seat. And then conversely, they were willing to allow, in the Episcopal government, allowed for noblemen to have a say in the governing and discipline of the church. Right, that's it's sort of what the High Commission is doing, but it got a little bit more direct from time to time. They reject that. Right? They don't like the meddling of the one with the other. They like the idea of cooperation, but they just simply don't like putting all of that power. So, for example, over the years, there have been a number of members of the U.S. Congress, whether the House or the Senate, who've been ministers. And if they had been members of Presbyterian churches, right, they would have been disciplined for that. They wouldn't have been allowed to be members of Congress, whether the House or the Senate. I think you can't be a minister in good standing and be in this other position as well, yeah.
So how did Ian Paisley get away with it? Was that after the church had already kind of...
Ian Paisley was a complete heretic.
Well, I'm not saying, but he was from a supposed Presbyterian church.
He was barely Presbyterian. I mean, the only... You know, he was right about a couple of things. And he even got kind of wobbly on that toward the end. But no, that is un... Presbyterian, it's unscriptural. Okay, within the Bible, there's a strict line of demarcation between the jurisdiction of the church and the state. You don't see anyone allowed to occupy both sides of that jurisdiction. It's just not allowed. So it's unbiblical, and it's anti-Presbyterian. Not just un-Presbyterian, but anti-Presbyterian. So when I say he was heretical, I mean in terms of his... And I know a lot of people are going to choke if they hear me say this, but he was in favor of certain kinds of ecumenical movements. And that's how he ended up in bed with Bob Jones University and a bunch of Arminian Baptists in South Carolina. Right? They agreed on a couple of things. And he compromised everything. And how you could even call it a Presbyterian church when they reject infant baptism for the most part uniformly now is beyond my ability to comprehend. It's foolishness, it's wickedness, and it's false advertising. So maybe at least the Better Business Bureau or something could put a mark next to their names, because I know the church won't do anything right now. All right. There are a couple of things in 108. What did the Free General Assembly of 1638 approve? Well, there were a couple of things, and that is, they approved presbyterial government, and then they also approved yearly general assemblies. Now, that's a big deal. You know, in 1638, they could look back on six general assemblies, and that would take them back to, the 1590s or early 1600s. You know, they had passed numbers of years from time to time without any general assembly. So now they're saying every year there's going to be a general assembly. We're going to deal with some issue every year. All right, question 109. We're moving on to England for a moment. We need to remember, as I said, that in 1638, the Church of Scotland renewed the National Covenant, and so the issue when England was awakened by the glory of the Lord, what did she do? England then, when there begins to be this religious awakening of sorts in England, for a number of reasons, sometime around 1640, they begin to wake up. We see that things are not going too well. They're dealing with a lot of issues, and they want help. And so they appeal and seek advice from Scotland. And 110, why did she appeal to Scotland? Because Scotland had been reformed to an advanced degree. In fact, it was a degree far beyond the continental Reformed churches. Now, around this time, England, this is in the early 1640s, England is concerned. There's this growing concern. 111, why was England grieved and what did she fear? She was grieved because the Puritan faction in the Church of England was severing into two parties, really. One was more Presbyterian, the other was congregational or independent. And the independents were actually gaining a bit of upper hand in the House of Commons. And I'm really trying to simplify some of the history, because there's a lot going on. There's a lot of nuanced history, but I just want you to understand some of the contours of what is happening here. So what happens is, in the Church of England, you have a few people who are moderate Episcopalians, a number of people who are leaning toward Presbytery, and then this rabid group of independents who are really gaining a lot of following. England becomes concerned, the church itself becomes concerned, because they don't want to be found differing in points of church government from other Reformed churches. Okay, they're concerned that they're going to fall too far afield of the Reformed churches in Holland, for example, or the French, or the Swiss. They're concerned about that, but they're especially concerned because they've heard tell, and probably some of them had some acquaintance with the Scots and the church in Scotland, which is by now solidly Presbyterian. The Scottish church would have been solidly Presbyterian a lot sooner than that had it not been for the Erastian influence of the king and the suppression of Presbyterians by the bishops. You know, Scotland is a country that really would have been happy to be strict Presbyterians at that time. would that she were still happy to be that. But what she feared was that this difference in government and discipline would lead to defection in worship and doctrine. So they want help. They want help because they are dealing with the rising sectaries, the independent people who you've got the wars beginning and being raged between the king and the parliament. And on the king's side, as the king wins, the papist faction is actually starting to reascend. On the Protestant, you know, the Protestant side, or the non-Anglican side, the non-Episcopal side, the Presbyterians and Congregationalists really are not getting on too well. Okay, there's a lot of arguing and infighting, and so they're afraid that they're not going to survive this. The English really want the Scots to help them in their fight against the king. The Parliament, particularly House of Commons, wants Scottish aid against the royal troops because they're getting beaten up pretty badly. They're losing a lot. It's never good for morale when you're losing a lot of battles. And they were. So the English appeal to the Scots, and what they want is a civil league. They want a league that is going to be the commitment on the part of the Scots to join arms with the armies of Parliament against the royalist troops. That, in a nutshell, is what is being proposed here. That, from the point of Scotland, is going to be rejected. The Scots are saying, listen, we would love to help you, but we cannot help you when you are clearly sectaries, when you are clearly of a different religious bent. Okay, we're not going to help you beat the Royal Army just so you can become a bunch of independents. So the Scots, they suggest a covenant. The result of this is, in 1643, and this is the result of the appeal from England to Scotland, the Solemn League and Covenant. It was designed to be a league and a covenant. Now, 113, what was the immediate effect of that? Once this was drawn up and approved by the assembly in Edinburgh and embraced in England, the Popish and Prelatic Party were struck through with great terror. They were fearful. Now, as a result of this Solemn League and Covenant, remember the Scots are saying, look, we'll help you, but you guys need to reform. For real. The result of it then is in 1643, this is question 114, they convene what?
Westminster Assembly.
The Westminster Assembly. For the purpose of carrying the end of the covenant regarding achieving uniformity in church doctrine, government, worship, and discipline. Okay. They said, we're going to help you militarily, but you have to pledge to seek to achieve a uniformity with us in doctrine, worship, government, and discipline. So at the time, they gathered the greatest theological minds in England. It has been said, probably not without some warrant, that there was more brain power in that assembly than had ever been called together in any other assembly in the history of the church, and certainly has not been equaled since. You had a number that the English brought, and we had the Scottish commissioners that I want to get to in a moment. But I think it is interesting, and also to the point, to note that there were people like William Twiss, who was the moderator, the initial moderator, though he dies in 1646. But Twiss, when the Romanists on the continent heard that Twiss had been appointed, they they almost lost it. They could not answer Twiss. No, I don't think anyone, frankly, could have answered Twiss. Twiss, when he was arguing and when he was on point, is quite possibly one of the most well-reasoned and cogent theologians that has ever appeared in the history of the church. And with, you know, with great ability, he dispatched a lot of Romish arguments at the time. So he was highly respected by Protestants and greatly feared by the Romanists. Now, the Scottish commissioners, question 115. These are the worthies from the Church of Scotland. Robert Bailey, minister. Alexander Henderson, minister. George Gillespie, minister. Samuel Rutherford, minister. Robert Douglas, minister. He never made it there, but he was called or commissioned. John Earl of Cassils, that's Cassils, ruling elder. John Lord of Maitland, another ruling elder. And then Archibald Johnston, Lord Waterston, ruling elder. So from the very beginning, The Scots are very forward to make sure that they're ruling elders. In Scottish Presbyterian government, sessions, oh, any kind of presbytery, whether it's sessional or presbyterial or general assembly, they're not looked at as being genuinely Presbyterian. There's certainly a defect in maybe a fatal defect, in depending on what happens, if you don't have ruling elders. Because the Reformed Church rejects Romanism, it rejects priesthood, you know, this idea of a priestly caste. So they want ruling elders who represent the people involved in these matters in church courts. Ruling elders are always going to have a hand in determining anything that has to do with the judgment and discipline of the church. So they send them right away. They send them. One 16, what principal things does Solemn League and Covenant contemplate? Contemplated really two things, right? First is the reformation of religion in England. And the second is a covenanted uniformity of the kingdoms. And by the kingdoms, we mean England, Scotland, Ireland. The Welsh may be alarmed at that, but they sort of, at this time, were, I think, treated as simply being part of England. Now, as this is all raging on, the assembly sits, and the assembly sits from 1643 until the end of the decade. At the same time, the English Civil War is being carried out, and in time, there are a number of defeats of the Royalist forces. Eventually, what we see is Oliver Cromwell and his New Model Army. And he doesn't really talk about this too much, but he takes the lead in this fight against Royalist forces. And Cromwell is at the head of these forces when, in 1649, they finally back Charles I into a corner. Charles is not going to yield the throne. Prince Louis is not going to recant. So, January 30th of 1649, question one, has to do with question 117. The independents, in particular, condemn and execute Charles the First. Now, we haven't really gotten into this yet. You might think the Covenanters were singing hallelujahs and praise the Lord's and all of that, because Charles I was, in some respect, a tyrant. He had become tyrannical. There were real problems with the guy. However, the Church of Scotland protests against the execution of Charles I, and the reason is because of the manner and motives of those who carried out. Now, we're coming to a period, well, at this period of time, Oliver Cromwell becomes essentially a military dictator. It is called the Republic, and I know a lot of Calvinists had very high regard for Cromwell. Church of Scotland has less fond memories of him. He was a military dictator. He enacted an authoritative toleration that did a lot to undermine the interests of true religion in Scotland, beside eventually forbidding or discharging them of having general assemblies in the church. Not to say he was all bad, but he was certainly not all good. And behind it all, he was really an independent. He was sectarian. He was, in fact, one of these early proponents of denominationalism. Denominationalism was thrust on the British Empire through military dictatorship. It wasn't what people would have wanted, but it was, generally speaking, the vast majority of people. But it was enforced through this military dictatorship, and there wasn't a whole lot you could do to fight back at the time. Cromwell had the upper hand. He controlled the military. During this time, people all over actually began to reminisce about the good old days when the Stuarts were in charge. And there was some talk. Charles I had he had several heirs. One had died young, but there was Charles II. He was the next in line, and then there was James II, who, as we're going to see later on in the next period, James II is a very big problem, because if Charles II was a closeted papist, James II is just an open papist. But the Presbyterians in Scotland think that they can cut a deal. So in 1651, they call Charles from exile to come to Scotland. And there, they go through a series of negotiations, which ends with Charles gaining their support. And here's what happens. Now, there are two things that are sort of bound up together here. First, 118, who was the only faithful witness against bringing back Charles II, and why? There was a minister named Adam Kai, K-A-E. He's the only one in 1651 who said this is a bad idea, at least publicly. Right. In other words, Oliver Cromwell's support, in particular in Scotland, is so thin, so shallow, as to be non-existent. Kai doesn't want him back because he believes Charles II was a perfidious traitor. And he foretold the mischief and misery that he was going to bring with him should he come back. Now, Shields doesn't get into it, and I'm not really sure about the accounts as to whether or not this is something that, say, a John Howie would have characterized as prophecy, but Kai knew that he was going to be bad news, and of course he's right about that ultimately. In order to avoid what they feared, the Covenanters in Scotland require Charles to do something to gain the support of the Church of Scotland, and that is they require him to subscribe to Solemn League and Covenant. And they have a big ceremony at the time, and Charles does do it, yeah.
So my question is, if this guy is known for being a perfidious traitor, why would you even tempt yourself with, like, you know, to bring him back into power. If he's proven himself to be a traitor, he doesn't matter how qualified he is, right? He should just be automatically disqualified from ever any kind of future office, right? I mean,
I think the problem is twofold. Okay, remember, in the Solemn League and Covenant, they've bound themselves to uphold the king in the defense of the true religion. So they have to give him a chance. Okay, they're saying, in terms of the covenant, we already pledged ourselves to support the king in his defense of the true religion. So if Charles II is going to say, I will defend the true religion, promote and defend the true religion, we've got to go with him. Cromwell certainly isn't. We're going to come back to some differences between Charles I and Charles II. You have to remember, at this time, as bad as Charles I might have been, from the point of view of the Presbyterians, Oliver Cromwell is equally, if not more, objectionable, and perhaps in some respect liable to the charge of arbitrary government, more than Charles I would have been. Now, at the same time that this is going on, right around the same time, this is question 120, who carried on a most violent defection from the covenanted Reformation, and by doing what? In 1651, this controversy erupts between two parties in the Church of Scotland. This is actually one reason I think Cromwell shuts down the General Assembly. But there are two parties. One party is called the Protesters. The other, the Resolutioners. The Resolutioners were the people who were in favor of a series of public resolutions that basically said, look, prior to this, we did not allow you to hold places of power and trust if you were a malignant. That is, if you were a covenant refuser or a covenant breaker. Okay? You couldn't hold a position of civil authority or power or trust. You couldn't serve in the military. You couldn't do all kinds of things in the civil realm. The public resolution said, we're going to waive that requirement in the public realm. Doesn't matter what you believe. Resolutioners within the church, the resolutioners who were the majority, said, sounds like a good idea to us. We probably need more people in the military. We're worried about Cromwell. The protesters said, no. Shall we do evil that good may come? We can't do this. Right? We can't allow this sort of thing to happen. So the resolutioners are the ones who carried on a violent defection from the covenanted Reformation, and they did it by bringing notorious malignants into places of trust in judicatories and armies. The controversy went on for a bit of time. It continued into 1652. If you notice, the Act Declaration and Testimony, the title of the Act Declaration and Testimony says, for the whole of our covenanted Reformation from the year 1638 to 49. But in 1650 and 51 and even in 52, the General Assembly sat before Cromwell finally dispersed them and told them no more because the fighting was so bad among them, the resolutioners and protesters. The reason we stop at 1649 is this. In 1650, there had been a General Assembly which had ended peaceably. And it had, the first thing a General Assembly does is ratifies or not the proceedings of the previous year, or the previous General Assembly. Like the first, you know, item of business, the first thing on the agenda, okay? They ratify the Assembly of 1649. That now becomes precedent. Okay, it can be appealed to for decisions. Its decrees are viewed as authoritative, and so on. Okay, but you need it. You have to remember each General Assembly consists of different ministers and elders. So you're not having. It's not the same persons. You know, sort of rubber stamping what they did the year before all the time in a national church. In 1651, when they met, it ended in a mess, and nothing was done. They didn't ratify 1650. 1650 has never been ratified. And of course, 1651 has not either. All right, so those are not part of covenanted reformation. When the subsequent assembly does not ratify, there's always this sort of sneaking suspicion that whatever the grounds of division were already present in the previous assembly. So this is going on in 1650, 51, 52... Question 121, and I think this is an interesting thing that he brings out. What signal event occurred when the public resolutions were concluded? And the answer is, the very day that the public resolutions were concluded at St. Andrews, Oliver Cromwell invaded, defeated the Covenanting armies at Dunbar, and there was a lot of bloodshed in Inverkeithing. Now, this controversy between protesters and resolutioners continues for quite some time. Of those Scottish commissioners that I mentioned, Robert Bailey was a resolutioner. Henderson died before this became an issue. George Gillespie and Samuel Rutherford were protesters. In 1660, as noted, that period of the Cromwell Republic, as they called it, came to an end. Oliver Cromwell died. His son Richard had assumed power for a little while. Didn't really work out. 1660, then Charles II is brought back. So after Cromwell's death, Oliver Cromwell, that is, who brought Charles II back to power? It was General Monk with a bunch of malignants and resolutioners at his back. The protesters did not participate in this. They were not happy about it. In fact, some of the resolutioners at this point began to admit that the protesters had been the true prophets and had been right all along. All right, we're going to go through, and I'm just going to kind of skim over these because there's so much material here, but the number of points he gives at the end of each section. Point one here, question 123, how was the testimony carried on during this period and against whom? Well, it was carried on impartially against popish, prelatic, and malignant factions on the one hand, and the sectarians or denominationalists on the other. I think we should just, you know, keep reminding ourselves, sectarians are denominationalists. Okay, if you think that denominationalism is okay, you're a sectarian. If you think it's a normal feature, you're a sectarian. It's not to say that we don't recognize it's happened, but that doesn't make it a legitimate expression of Christianity at all. All right, question 124 then. If some were to condemn those suffering in Shield's time for these things, according to our author, they must also condemn who or what? Well, during this time, the sufferers, Shield says, if you're going to condemn them, you might as well condemn the General Assembly that first testified against the things that they're now suffering over. He cites a letter, by the way, to the Assembly of Divines at Westminster, dated Edinburgh, June 18, 1646, where the authors of the letter, the commissioners or whoever it is from Scotland, say, the smallest of Christ's truths, the smallest of Christ's truths, if it be lawful to call any of them small, is of greater moment than all the other businesses that ever have been debated since the beginning of the world to this day. And they go on, but that's, I think, just an interesting insight on their part. All right, question 125. What kind of pattern did the sufferers of this period leave us? This is the second point. In the manner of maintaining the testimony, they left a perfect pattern of purity and strictness against all conformity and compliance with corruption. When we talk about the Second Reformation, it really is. I mean, they're more consistent in carrying out their principles, and they're less concerned for consequences than any time before or since, in many respects. Right, 126. What in Shield's day signally demonstrated the abandonment of this pattern by many? They'd been strict and pure against all conformity, but then all of a sudden, and we're going to get into this more, they began embracing and receiving what were called indulgences. Okay, the king began to say, look, I know you've been in exile, I know you got ejected, you lost your church or whatever. You want to preach? You want to teach in the church again? Here's the deal. You won't talk about me anymore. Leave politics out of your discussions, and we'll leave you unmolested. As long as you swear that you won't touch any political matter, we'll let you back in your churches. Not wholly unlike the agreement that the churches make with the 501c3 status, particularly with that Johnson Amendment in place. All right, or the Johnson Rule, whatever it is. 127. What demonstration of the strictness of those during this period does our author evince? Yeah, when he's trying to explain how strict they are, how circumspect they are, he points out this. Here's what they actually did in 1646. They had among their acts one for censuring ministers for not speaking in a public cause or for speaking ambiguously. So if there is a public controversy, public cause, and you're a minister, you're not allowed to remain silent, nor are you to allowed to speak ambiguously. You have to come right out and just speak your mind. You know, you've got to get it out there. (clears throat) 128, what contendings by the General Assembly are brought forth to evidence this further? And it then goes on after some quotes regarding the censuring of ministers who were silent. He talks about this act of General Assembly for censuring those who complied with the public enemies of church and state. That's one thing. The other thing that he cites is an act against all oaths and bonds in the common cause imposed without the consent of the church. So with the restoration, Charles II is trying to peel people away from the church who will compromise. And they're censuring people who are going to fall into this trap. All right. Question 129. What kind of associations would Shields have us note as being reprobated by the faithful of this period? The answer is all associations with persons disaffected with the cause at hand. Anybody know what these associations are generally called?
Voluntary associations.
Voluntary associations. All voluntary associations with people who are disaffected with the cause at hand. So, at this very early period, they're saying we don't join hands with malignants or resolutioners or covenant breakers or covenant despisers. We won't join hands with anyone in a political or moral cause who isn't committed, first of all, to these principles under which we've covenanted. (130) What dying man left his testimony against these associations? Want to give a guess to that one?
George Gillespie.
George Gillespie. Gillespie leaves his dying testimony against voluntary associations. Think about all the things he might have wanted to protest as he was dying, or leave, you know, some testimony. He picks voluntary associations. All right, 131. What objection does Shields consider drawn from the practice of those during this period that many in his day were advancing? He says, well, here's what they were saying, that the godly during this period didn't separate from those who complied and made defection from the truth. Right? They wouldn't separate from those people. They just, they sort of maybe marked them, but they weren't going to separate from them. Now, question 132, what reasons does he give for rejecting their conclusion drawn from this period? In other words, why does he reject this idea that they, that these people want to say they didn't separate from those who complied? He gives three reasons. First, he says, as a matter of fact, many did withdraw, even from their own ministers. Okay, that's the first point. Second point is, that the church then was still in a constituted state when all this started, okay? So, and we're going back to, we're not really at 1660, we're going back and we're talking about that period of time, you know, after, see, 1649, when this starts to become an issue with the protester and resolutioner controversy running. The church is still in a constituted state wherein they could appeal their case to higher church courts for redress of their grievances. And the third is the defection had not been so long or entrenched so that all hope of the matters being addressed by the General Assembly to take order were gone. So what they're saying is, you know, if the church were still constituted, in a constituted state, that would be one thing. Remember, many did separate. Of those who didn't, we're not going to necessarily condemn them because they had the right of appeal before them. They could still appeal. Of course, you know, when that's taken away, then there isn't really any appeal, right? I mean, there's nowhere to go with this. And the other is, this was just happening. We couldn't really be sure, even if we took it to court, how the church courts were going to rule. All right, we're up to the third point that he makes here. Question 133, during this period, we have an illustrious testimony to what principle? And the answer is to the principle of the duty of defensive arms against the civil, or excuse me, the sovereign power. And he quotes some things that make very clear that they believed that they had a right when things got too far out of hand. They reserved the right to defend themselves with arms against the sovereign power. All right, 134, what were the reforming fathers of this period able to distinguish regarding magistratical authority? And I think this is a good thing to point out. They were able to distinguish between authority and the person abusing it. Mm-hmm. So they're not denying magistrates. But they are denying that a magistrate has a right to do whatever he wants to do, regardless. 135. What objection does Shields consider an answer regarding this point? And how does he answer it? Well, he answers this question regarding authority and the person abusing it by pointing out, first of all, the third article of the covenant enjoined the defense of the king's majesty and person in the preservation and defense of true religion and liberties of the kingdoms. And then from that, the second thing is, he says this very article then makes the king's power limited and conditional. It's subordinate unto God's jurisdiction. We're going to preserve him in his defense of the true religion and liberties of the kingdoms. So if he becomes somewhat embracing sectarianism or something heretical, we're under no obligation here. If he, on the other hand, turns against the liberties of the people or the kingdoms, we're not binding ourselves to defend him in that either. So they're saying right in the covenant, we're giving you our limitations. We're not in this no matter what. The king has to behave himself. All right, question 136. What two things owned in the testimony during Shield's time seem to be neither confirmed nor consistent with the testimony of the period under consideration? And the two things that he mentions This is point four, by the way. He says the two things are, number one, the right of private persons to execute extraordinary judgments, and number two, refusing to own the present tyrant's authority. Now, there are reasons for that. No one disowned. What he's saying is no one during this period of time, or prior to this, no one disowned, say, Charles I. Right? And no one was asserting the right of private persons executing extraordinary judgments during that time. And he just says, look, I'm going to get to it. Okay, I will explain to you why. But he wants to give us, and this is the last question, what five differences does our author enumerate to justify disowning the present tyrant's authority? Well, first of all, he says Charles I, remember which king was Charles I? Charles I ended his reign approximately 10 inches shorter than he began. Why?
Beheaded.
He was beheaded. Okay? Charles I never declared parliamentarily that neither promises, contracts, or oaths should bind him. Okay? But Charles II did. Charles I never presumed to rule against Parliament. He was involved in that civil war, but he never came out and just said Parliament is, you know, basically inherently a problem. Charles II did. That makes a big difference whether you're going to own someone or not as a tyrant, okay? The second thing, he points out that there's a mutual stipulation and obligation between the king and the people. As both are tied to God, so each of them are tied to one another. There's this idea of performance of mutual and reciprocal duties. Charles II did not uphold his end of the bargain, basically. Whereas Charles I, it's harder to say that he didn't when it comes to those constitutional principles, you know, given where things were at that time. Third in the League and Covenant, the duty of defending and preserving the king is subordinate, as we already talked about a little bit, to the duty of preserving religion and liberty. So when you have a king like Charles II, and especially James II, as we'll see, basically disavowing that he has to defend or preserve true religion or defend the liberties of the people, that is something that's going to be problematic. Right. Fourth, it was for the restraint of arbitrary government and for just defense against tyranny the Lord's people did join in covenant. But Charles II's arbitrary government had shed too much blood over the preceding years. And then fifth, being admitted before satisfaction, we're talking about Charles II, he endeavored an overturning of the things which God had wrought and labored to draw public administrations concerning religion and liberty into that course and channel in which they did run under prelacy and before the work of Reformation. So Charles II, upon being admitted to the throne, endeavors to overthrow the very covenanted work of Reformation that he had sworn to uphold. Right. That is an overview of this section. And that's all that happened, really, in the space of 22 years. And on a lot of these points, we could have spent a lot more time. But the purpose is to survey what is really just a survey in Shields and move on so that you have a sense of what is in this book and why it's important. Okay, so next time we want to take up period 6, which, as I say, will continue from 1660 on to 1687 when A Hind Let Loose was written.